Okay, so we're gonna dive right in here. We normally have a little music to dance to, but do you feel like dancing?
Not right now. I'm wearing shorts, so I don't know if.
Sure, you're wearing shorts.
Okay. I wear my t-shirt and shorts on Friday, but I changed into a button down for the podcast.
That's awesome. I appreciate that.
Welcome to Credit Alchemy, a podcast that's going to help you finally get your shit together so you can transform your credit, your money, and your mindset. Hosted by Michelle Mitchell, the Credit Alchemist, and Karen Beckles, a.k.a. the Gatekeeper. They're two credit specialists based out of Oakland, California, and they're changing people's lives every single day. You ready to make that change?
So we have a special guest today. He is a consumer attorney, an awesome one, actually. We use him a lot in our business at 760 Credit. He's gotten some money for our customers, and that is really exciting for us. His firm does FCRA and FDCPA lawsuits. And yeah, I mean, Ari, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So again, my name is Ari Marcus. I run a law firm called Marcus & Zelman. We focus on consumer litigation. So the only thing we do is we represent consumers against debt collectors, against banks, against the credit bureaus, you name it. We don't charge any money for the kind of work we do, which is fortunate for our clientele. We mainly focus on FDCPA litigation. So what that is that means we'll review all correspondences from collection agencies, whether letters, voicemails, phone calls, you name it, and we'll review to make sure they're compliant with federal law. And when I say the FDCPA, that's an acronym for the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act, which is a law that was enacted in the 1970s, which told debt collectors pretty much don't lie to consumers, don't make false threats, treat everyone fairly. So we're making sure that consumers and consumers are treated fairly, and if they're not, then we can sue the debt collector for their consumer.
Oh, that's awesome. And we've had some pretty happy clients with some nice, healthy checks because the rights being violated in one way or another. Can you tell us about some of the most common ways that collectors like to violate our rights?
Yes, that's right. Well, they like to lie to you because the more they lie, the more they mislead, then the higher chances they are to collect from you. So we see a lot of debt collectors either on the phone or even in a collection letter mislead consumers to think that interest or late fees are accruing when they're not. So it's important to know, how much is the debt that I owe? Did the original creditor stop charging interest? And if they have, and the debt collector is sort of threatening me with, hey, pay up quicker, because if you don't pay up, the balance may increase. That's obviously a lie. So that's something to look out for. Debt collectors who lie about possibly going to court to sue you, especially on older debts. And it's become more and more common for debt collectors to collect on old, what's called zombie debts. These are debts that are, you know, 6, 7, 10, 15, 20 years old, and they have no right to sue you on them anymore because they're past what's called the statute of limitations. But we've seen more and more debt collectors threaten consumers, especially on the phone. We tell all our clients to make sure to jot down what happens on a phone conversation, keep records of it so we can review it when you're done with that phone call. And then other common violations are calling consumers at inconvenient times, so either late at night or early in the morning. Or we have consumers who tell debt collectors, look, I work from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. I can't get personal calls, so don't call me during that time. And they continue to get called during that time. So those are some of the common ones we've been seeing lately.
Is it sufficient that you just tell them over the phone that you don't want to be called, or do you have to write them a letter?
Okay, that's a great question. So what the law says is if you want all communications to stop, all phone calls to stop, you have to do that in writing. So that's A. B, the law also says is that a debt collector cannot contact you at any time or place that's inconvenient for you. And that is something that you can tell them over the phone. So while you can't tell them over the phone, I don't want you to call me ever, you could say, I don't want you to call me during these times, or I don't want you to call me during dinner time because I'm with my family. Mm-hmm. Now the debt collector's put on notice that that's inconvenient for you. And if they contact you again, that would be a violation.
Do you suggest court calls and stuff like that? Can you use that, especially if you say, hey, I'm recording it as well, to the person that's on the phone? Can that be used?
Yes. So I don't want to give anyone advice on recording because every state is different.
Okay.
So, for example, I'm located in New Jersey. In New Jersey, you can record a phone call without notifying the other party. It's called a one-party consent state. As long as one person in the phone call knows it's recorded and you are that one person, it's allowed. Other states are two-party consent, so those you have to notify the other side. So just it's pretty simple to look it up, but I don't want to give anyone advice on that because it's a state-by-state issue. But if you're not sure, yes, notify the other side. I'm recording the phone call, and then you can continue recording it. Some of them will hang up on you, but others will continue talking.
Yeah, I actually have experienced that myself, where she was like, oh, I don't feel comfortable. I'm like, well, you're recording me.
Right, right.
That sounds just like crazy. So you're recording me. Am I going to get a copy of the recording? What's happening here? So anyway, but yeah, she did refuse, and I respected that, and then we went on. You review a lot of our collection letters, and we've learned a lot of stuff from you about things to look for on an actual collection letter, because there's a lot of times I'll read these collection letters, and it just does not feel right. I'm like, that don't feel right. They're not saying anything. You know, like, this can't be legal. Are there some things that are really easy to find on the letter that you would not mind taking a look at that letter afterwards?
Sure. I mean, the law is always changing. What I mean is case law is always changing. There's new court decisions that come out. So we like to review all letters, and we keep letters because if a new case comes out, then we'll go back and review those letters again to see if they're compliant. But some common things we see is in a first letter, a debt collector has to notify you of five different things. So A, they have to tell you who the current creditor is. And a lot of times we'll see debt collectors only list who the original creditor is. So they'll say, oh, you had an account with Verizon, now we're trying to collect on it. But they're not clear whether Verizon still owns it, whether they sold it, whether the debt collector now owns it. So if it's not clear who the current creditor is, that's a violation. They also have to tell you the amount of the debt. Now, all of them list the amount. However, if interest is accruing, so for example, they send you a letter, it's dated January 1st, and it says you owe $100. You received a letter on January 5th. So now you no longer owe $100 if interest is accruing on a daily basis. You owe $100 plus some change. So if interest is accruing and they don't tell you interest is accruing, that's another violation we see. And then there's something called a validation notice. And this is a little bit more nuanced, but there's a specific paragraph that have to notify you of your rights to dispute a debt. And the shortened version of it is, unless you, the consumer, dispute within 30 days a receipt, we will assume it's valid. If you dispute in writing, we'll get verification. If you dispute in writing, we'll tell you who the name of the original creditor is. That paragraph is very important to a consumer. And a lot of times debt collectors, for one reason or another, will mess up that paragraph. They'll add words in that shouldn't be in there. So when the first sentence where you can dispute orally, they may add in, we'll only accept the dispute over the phone. And that obviously is incorrect. Or vice versa, while your dispute to get verification has to be in writing and have to tell you it's in writing, sometimes they'll leave out the word in writing. And that's what's known in the industry as overshadowing your rights, because now you're confused, you're not sure what your rights are. So we find a lot of violations within that paragraph. Other things to look out for besides those are, like I said earlier, if there's any mention of interest accruing when interest is not accruing, that's a violation. If there's any threat of litigation when the debt collector had no intent to sue you, those are things that should stick out. But like I said initially, unless you're in the business, unless you're reviewing letters and reviewing case law, you're not going to know all the violations. So the more you send us, the more we'll review and we'll let you know.
Okay. Now, you said intent to sue. So how would you know if someone's really their intention is to really sue?
So a couple things to look out for. if the debt's like for $30 and they're intending and they're saying they're going to sue you, that's a pretty good indicator they have no intention of suing you. If you get a lawyer's letter and the lawyer's in New York and you live in Texas, for example, that's another good indicator. The lawyer's not licensed in Texas, so they probably can't even legally sue you. So that's another thing to look out for. If the debt is really old, so what I said earlier, it's past the statute of limitations, there they have no legal right to sue you. So clearly they have no intent. And then some letters are really specific. They'll say, you got 30 days to pay this. If you don't pay it in 30 days, we're going to sue you. And then 6 months down the line, you still haven't been sued. We can go back and make a good argument that when they sent that letter saying you have 30 days to pay, they had no intention because 6 months has gone by. And we have a case now against Portfolio Recovery Associates that they did exactly that. What they would do is they'd send you their first letter and say, we send it to our legal department. If you don't pay within 6 weeks, we're going to have our lawyers review it and they're going to sue you. And their policy always was that when those 6 weeks ended, they'd send a second letter and saying, hey, here's your second chance or your last chance. But they did it in every situation. So we argued Portfolio, when they sent that first letter, knew they had no intention of suing. Mm-hmm. And they made that false deadline. So those are some things you can look for to figure out whether they had an intent to sue. But yeah, that's a great question because that's always their argument. Like, how do I know what their intention is at that time? But those are good ways to, you know, get a good case moving forward.
Awesome. If you were to tell our consumers when they get a call, like, what's the best practice of, like, being on the phone with them? You know, like, because they can be aggressive and they can, I always tell my customers, and I hope that I'm actually saying the right thing, is that, you know, you're not going to admit to anything on the phone. You know, you want to get information. You know, you want them to send it to you in writing so that you have something that says what it is they're talking about. And you can actually see it. You can compare it to your records, if there are any. You know, do you think that was the right message, or what would you tell?
Yeah, that's 100% right. There are a lot of scams out there, and just because they have information that you owe a debt doesn't necessarily mean they have the right to collect the debt. They may not be licensed. They may just be a scam. They may just have hacked into information and now they're trying to collect from you. So always get things in writing. Try and find out what their license number is, especially if it's an agency or a credit collection agency that you've never heard of before. But what I told my clients is that I have a lot of clients who are uncomfortable on the phone. They just feel terrible, and it ruins their day when the collection agency calls. And I tell them, if it's going to ruin your day, it's not worth even talking to them. Get off the phone with them. Let me know. I'll send them a letter. I'll tell them to cease communications. But if you are comfortable, yes, you get as much information as you can out of them. Ask them to send it in writing. Never admit to anything. Those are great pieces of advice. It's exactly what I would say.
You know, I do have a question about that. You said whether or not they're actually able to collect this debt or legally, or if they, how would you determine whether or not they are legally able to collect the debt?
Sure. Most states have a website you could go on to look this up. It's really not, you'd have to go through a little bit of Google search, but if you search like the Attorney General website, then a lot of them have just a search bar, like search collection agency, they'll tell you if they're licensed or not.
Okay, so when you say legally able to, it's just a matter of whether or not they're licensed, not so much that, because like, well, what are the ways that a collection company can get your name? Can they get it from a distressed debt list? Can they, you know, the debt sold, transferred, placed? What are the different?
Great question.
Yes, so to your first point, some states have specific rules that you have to be licensed and bonded, some don't, so you have to know your state law.
California doesn't have, I believe California, you don't have to be necessarily licensed in California. Is that true?
I'd have to double check that. I thought California, you needed to have a license to collect there. But how do they get your information? I mean, they need to get your information from the creditor. And they may be the creditor in that situation because they may be the debt purchaser. They're buying the debt. But they can't go out and find your information from a third party. So the only way they can really legally get your information is from the company that currently owns the debt.
And have you found that they have gotten information in another way other than that?
So yes, We found they utilize what's called skip tracing to get your information. That's more of an issue with what's called the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. So then calling you without your permission, not so much with the FDCPA.
Okay, got it. Yeah, so, you know, I've had collection companies tell me that they, you know, like, so if I've called them and, you know, they've sent me validation for the debt, was able to review it, say, okay, yeah, this looks about legitimate, right? Is there a difference between how you deal with a collection company who owns the debt and one who does not own the debt? Is there a difference in how to deal with them? And do they have someone that owns the debt, do they have more rights than, say, a collection company that doesn't?
So it depends. If you're asking about the original creditor versus a debt collector, yes, an original creditor does not have to comply with the FDCPA. That law only applies to third-party debt collectors.
So when you say third-party debt collector, that means that they don't actually own the debt. So if there's a actual collection company who's purchased the debt from, say, Verizon, okay, mm-hmm. and they now own it, are they now the original
creditor? So there's two situations that occur, but in most situations, a debt purchaser is in the same field as a debt collector. So they all have to comply with the FDCPA. So you have a third party, someone like Midland Credit or Portfolio Recovery, and their business is debt buying, and they buy defaulted debts. They have to comply with the FDCPA just like a debt collector. The only situations where that doesn't apply is if they buy the debt that's not yet in default. So that would be, you take out a mortgage. The first thing the mortgage does is they sell it to a third party. You're not yet in default yet, but that's their business. So that debt buyer, whatever you want to call it, they would now stand in the shoes of an original creditor and not have to comply with the FDCPA. But in most situations that your consumers are dealing with, where you're getting letters from debt collectors, and now they're owned by LVNV Funding, Crown Asset Management, Midland, Portfolio, the big guys, all those debt buyers also have to comply with the FDCPA.
So when we ask the collection company, and we ask them for information to prove that they have the right to ask me for money, what are they really legally are supposed to provide to me? I think a bill or a statement you can find in my garbage can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have a real big issue with that whole idea of just sending me a bill.
It's a big issue. And unfortunately, under the FDCPA, their requirements to validate a debt are very small. All they have to do is show that it's the right person and the right amount. So that they have the right RE Marcus, for example. Let's say there's five of them. They just have to prove that they're collecting from the correct RE Marcus. And that may just be showing a bill with my name and my address. I'm like, look, here's your name and address. So their requirements under the FDCPA are small. Now, it's not to say they have enough proof to win a case in court. If they walk in with a bill, that may not be enough. But just with regards to validating debt under the FDCPA, that's the only thing they need to show to continue collecting the debt.
Mm-hmm. If you were to ask for more information in order to confirm that something is yours, because, yeah, you could have my name and it could be a bill. But if I requested more information, like how I wanted them to verify or validate the debt, do they have any obligation to provide anything?
Not under the FDCPA. However, in California, you can ask for specific documents from a debt purchaser. California has a new law, it's I think like 3 years old now, which says that if a debt buyer now is trying to collect the debt, or even if they hire a third party, you can then ask for the contract, you'd ask for your signature, you could ask for specific documents. So California debt buyer, yes. FDCPA, rest of the country, not so much.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So, you know, all of this, I feel like we're just kind of like spewing out stuff, you know, tell me about the fun stuff that you do in your business. Like, why did you decide FDCPA? Like, you know, it doesn't sound all that sexy, but I'm sure, I mean, you know, I'm sure that there is something that just, ooh, gets your goat. So tell us about that. Tell us about a meaty case or something that's just, that we would find really interesting.
A meaty case. Okay, so how I got into FDCPA, when we started out, I did just general practitioner work. So I did everything. Real estate closings, driving tickets, DUIs, You name it. A little bit of civil litigation. I kind of fell into FDCPA. We had a couple of clients getting collection letters, complaining, and that's when I started researching the law and I got really into it. Part of the reason why I got into it is because it's really simple. It's a fairly easy statute to read. It's only a couple pages. It's not like the FCRA, which is a ton of pages and very complicated, and it's got a lot of legal terms. The FDCPA, anybody can read that and they shouldn't have a problem. Easy was one thing. Two, like I said earlier, the FDCPA requires the debt collector to pay my fees at the end of the case. So it was very enticing for me that I could now get clientele that I didn't have to bill. I hated that part of my practice, you know, counting my hours and, you know, billing for a phone call or billing for an email and then fighting clients to pay me. So this was an easy way for me to get clients. And while it may not sound sexy to some, I love the FDCPA. It's fun. It's fun going after debt collectors. It's fun turning the tables on them. So while they're attacking my client, they hire me, and then all of a sudden everything changes. And we just get so many happy clients. It's nice when you send your client a check and they tell you, you know, how it changed their lives and all that stuff. And we do a lot of what's called class action litigation. So if our clients get a letter violation, there's something wrong with the letter, we assume that everyone in that state got the same letter. They're not changing letters person to person. And that's when it gets really exciting and sexy. That's when the cases get really big. So I was telling you before about that portfolio case. We actually sent out letters to, I think, 12,800 people yesterday. And that's that class notice that maybe some of you have gotten in the past. Say, hey, you're part of a class action. Your rights have been violated. And then in terms of stories, we have, you know, interesting cases. We have a client now who, and this is more on the FCRA side, and it's just in my head because I was dealing with it this morning, where Discover Bank was reporting her as dead on her credit report. And because of that, obviously she wasn't dead, and she's not, and she was sending them letters and telling them, no, I'm not dead. But because of that, they closed her bank account. She was just living on Social Security. She couldn't deposit her check. She couldn't pay her rent. And these are sad stories. And to get clients like that and to get them back on their feet, she almost lost her apartment over it because she couldn't pay her rent. Luckily, she had a friend who came in and lent her money, because while she walked to her bank account and said, I'm physically here, they're like, sorry, we can't reopen your account because you're reported as dead. So to get clients like that and to help them out means a lot to us. I'm just trying to think offhand of any other interesting cases. We had a client who got a letter from a collection agency. This was pretty out there. The collection agency wrote on the letter, you know, how would your church and your friends feel if we posted a bulletin that you owe us money? And they actually created an Excel file online that anyone could go on, and it had the person's name and address and the amount they owed on it.
Oh, wow.
So that was pretty wild. We got that place shut down, which was, we got the client money. And the place shut down afterward. So we get interesting cases, and helping consumers, just, I could sleep well at night. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy coming to work every day. So that's why we do it.
You're listening to Credit Alchemy, brought to you by 760 Credit, the number one credit repair company in California.
That's fantastic. I just have a question. For those class action suits, I mean, like, how do you get, is it, you subpoena the collection company to give you like whoever you sent this letter out to? Like, how do you find all the people, all the other people that may have gotten that letter?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So after we file suit, if the case moves forward, we go through a process that's called discovery, and we'll ask them to send us the amount of people. Usually we'll get pushback, but we've had a lot of success fighting them, and eventually they're going to have to give us the names and everyone who got it. We have like 1 year to sue under the FDCPA, so any letters that are over a year old are too old. So they'll, within that year period, let us know who got that letter.
Aaron, do you have any additional questions for him? Because I know that she's on the ground floor with the consumers every day, and she hears so many things. I mean, from people coming to her to doorsteps and stuff.
Yeah. So if you have a collections company and they are collecting, let's say, from Verizon, if the consumer pays Verizon and Verizon accepts that, the payment, can we now get it off of the credit report? I mean, is it, you know, this company is no longer able to collect this debt. So that's what we can get the original creditor to accept the payment.
Okay, and are you asking, can you get the debt collector off the report or Verizon off the report?
So what I noticed is Verizon and those companies, they only stay off a minute and then they like sell the debt. So right. Now you've got the collections. But if the consumer can pay the creditor and they accept it, like Verizon or
sure,
and you got, let's say, ERC on the report, likely that we were able to dispute with the bureaus to get it off because now they're no longer collecting the debt?
Well, definitely if there's still is the balance, you should get the balance down to zero. And if they're reporting a balance, that's an inaccuracy and it may lead to it having to come off your report. Most of the debt collectors have a contract with the credit bureaus and with the clients that say that they can't do pay for delete. So that would be, I'm going to pay you X amount or the whole amount, and in return, you're going to remove it from my credit report. So they may tell you on occasion, we legally can't, you know, do pay for delete, we can't remove it, but that's not true. Just because they have a contract with the credit bureaus or with the original creditor doesn't make it illegal for them to do pay for delete. So they can legally do it. They can break their contract and do it. And we see on a lot of occasions they actually do that because all they care about is getting money. They don't really care about it staying on your report. So there is a possibility for that to come off on that end. Two, you can always tell a debt collector, look, I'm paying you because it's on the report, but I still don't think that I owe this. I still believe that it's inaccurate reporting. I still believe that I shouldn't have a balance. And if that's the case, that's how I usually would structure my clients to tell them. You're not doing pay per delete. You're removing it because I'm disputing it and I don't believe I owe it. I'm just paying you because I don't want to deal with this headache anymore. I don't want you guys contacting me anymore. So those are avenues you could go. But in your scenario, if ERC is reporting and you skip over ERC and go right to Verizon, they don't have to remove it from your credit report and they may not. So sometimes it's better to contact ERC just so you could make an agreement with them directly, especially if they're the only ones reporting now.
Can you tell me, re-aging, do you see that as being a big problem with a lot of collection companies?
Huge problem.
Okay.
Yeah. So re-aging essentially is every creditor or furnisher, they only have a certain amount of time they can report on your credit report. It's usually around 7.5 years from the date of last activity. That's, you know, it changes a little bit, but that's essentially what you're looking at. What would happen a lot of times is you'd have a date of last activity. A couple of years would go by. There's no activity. Now they sell the debt to a debt collector or debt purchaser, and they'd report it. But they'd report it as the date they purchased the debt as opposed to the date of last activity. And now what that does is that leaves them 7.5 years from the date they're reporting instead of 7.5 years from the date of last activity, which is a violation.
Can you define date of last activity real quick?
Date of last activity usually means the date, the last time you made payment on it, or certain contracts you have, they tell you when a debt goes into default. So for example, you may have a mortgage and the mortgage says, if you don't pay for 3 months for 90 days, then you're in default. So the first 90 days, even though you're late, you're not in default. So a lot of times they'll consider the date of last activity when that 90 days is up. So it's either date of default or date of last payment. And when I say date of last payment, that's like a medical debt because you don't have a contract that says when it goes into default, but you assume if you are on a payment plan and whenever you made that last payment and you've never paid after that, that's when you're in default. So that's usually what we mean by date of last activity.
Okay. And how can one find out which way that they mean by that? You know, like, for instance, if I'm dealing with a collection company and they don't have to provide me with an original agreement, how would I know which date?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean,
the consumer should know, especially on these old debts, that if portfolio, for example, is reporting that your date of last activity was 2018 and you're like, look, I haven't made a payment on this since 2013. Clearly, you know, they're re-aging the debt. And those are things that we look for. Usually when the purchase date and the date of last activity are very similar or identical, that's a red flag for us. But otherwise, the consumer is going to have to know on their own. And they're going to have to maybe do a little bit more research.
But you know, I wanted to go back to what you said about the collections, the things they're not, the things they're not supposed to do. So when you're on a phone call with a debt collector and they're yelling at you, right? And hey, Ari, are you liking that mattress you're sleeping on? When are you going to pay it? So if someone's not recording the call, how do you prove that this person was talking crap to you?
It's hard. It's, you know, they're supposed to record the calls, but, you know, obviously we find when we sue them, they mysteriously, you know, they just disappear, these recordings. But that's why I have my clients say, look, if you're not sophisticated enough to record, if you're not comfortable with the recording, just have a pen and paper and jot it down. Usually the judge will agree with you if you're taking notes during the time of the call that your notes are accurate, as opposed to them who had this missing recording and they're telling you a different story. So that's what I try to have my clients do. It's not always, they don't always do it, but you know, we try and push that. Otherwise it's a very difficult case. It's a he said, she said case, and those are hard to win.
Okay, yeah, that's really good to know. I have a couple of people that do take really, really good notes. And like you said, once the company says this call has been recorded, you're assuming it's being recorded. And if you really take really good notes, it should be helpful in winning the case, like you said, as opposed to we don't have the audio. So, okay, that's good to know. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what can a consumer expect if you do find a violation? What's like the next step? Mm-hmm. You know, or you think you have a violation, what's your next step in the whole process? And then how much can they get if they,
Great, that's a good question. So if we think there's a violation, we always have our initial, what's called consultation or initial talk with the client. And we'll walk them through A through Z. This is what you should expect. This is how the case is gonna move forward. And typically the way these cases work is client will retain us. Again, there's no cost to them. So we'll cover the filing fee, which is around $400. We'll cover what's called serving the defendant, so that we have to hire a process server. That's around $100. And any cost moving forward, depositions, discovery, that's all on my end. And what we're suing for is we're suing for statutory damage and actual damage. So under the law, a consumer is entitled to up to $1,000 for the violation. So that's what we're suing for. On top of that, if our client has any actual damage, we're suing for that. And actual damage could be client overpaid because they were charging interest when they weren't allowed to. Clients were getting phone calls at work, which stressed them out or got them in trouble. That's actual damage. The client couldn't sleep at night because they were getting harassed. There's all different ways that they could get actual damage, but that's essentially what we're suing for. And if we prevail or we settle, client will get up to $1,000, client will get actual damage. And like I said earlier, I will get reimbursed my fees and hours. So we're not taking a piece of the client's recovery. On top of that, if we settle, especially with debt buyers, we'll always push, and I can't guarantee it because it's not in the law, but we'll always push to get debt waiver and trade line deletion. So we'll get it off your credit report and we'll get the debt removed. Now, we can't always guarantee that because some debt collectors don't own the debt. They're collecting on behalf of, let's say, Verizon. But if that's the case, we'll almost always get them to agree to return it to Verizon and say, look, we don't want you collecting it anymore. So they'll have to return the account. So that's what we're hoping to get for the clients. And the way these lawsuits usually work, we try and push for early settlement. I mean, everyone always asks me, what's the timeline? The timeline is very difficult. It depends on the facts. It depends on who we're suing. But it's our goal to get this resolved as quickly as possible.
Awesome. And would you say that once you're retained, what's your success rate? I mean, do you only take cases that you're gonna win? It's like, oh well, it didn't work out.
Yeah, no, there's definitely some. My job as a plaintiff's attorney is to push the envelope. If my only cases are easy cases, I'm not doing my job. So we on occasion take cases that are more interesting or not so clear cut. But again, to file it, it costs me about $500 just up front. So clearly I feel confident in the case if I'm going to take it. I'm not taking stupid cases because those create bad case law. Those make us look bad. The judges aren't happy. But yeah, we don't win every case. We win a lot of them. We win a majority of them, a big majority. But on occasion, we'll get a bad decision or we'll have an interesting theory that just, you know, the judge didn't buy, and it happens.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you were going to recommend some really good reads to our consumer when it comes to, you know, even some laws and stuff, just to be aware of, not just the act, the FDCPA, but are actually like, you know, are there any UCC codes, any other reading that they could do past this to kind of just get them, you know, feel, empower them, you know, to feel like more confident when, you know, when they're dealing with these codes?
Yes. I know you said aside from the FDCPA, but I just point out, that's the first read everyone should have. It's not a difficult read. I would never advise people to read the FCRA because it's just out there and it doesn't make a lot of sense. But the FDCPA is an easy read. It's only a couple pages. You want to really focus from section A through section like G, all the sections afterward. You know, you could read, but they're not as important. Aside from that, I tell clients to read their state FDCPA law. Now, not every state has one, but California does, Florida does, New York does. So some of the states do. So look for those because those sometimes may offer you additional rights that the FDCPA doesn't have. If you just want basic rights and you want to feel empowered, know the FDCPA.
Okay. Awesome. Is there any last questions you have for Ari, Karen?
Yeah, I do. What about judgment. Is there anything that could violate a consumer's right when judgments are processed or placed or
Yes. So judgments are a really difficult topic and we could spend a couple hours on them, but I'll be brief. So federal court, so when we sue under the FDCPA, we typically sue in federal court. Judgments are ones you'll get in state court. That's your typical, you know, I'm suing you for breach of contract, you owe me money, et cetera.
So judgments are not normally federal at all, they're all state?
No. You could get judgments in federal law, but the judgments you're referring to are typically in state law. So those are the typical collection cases. Those are almost exclusively done in state court.
Okay. And
what I'm getting at is, if you are in state court and you lose, and usually when you get a judgment, that means you lost, whether by default you didn't show up or you had a trial and lost. Federal courts are wary. They really don't want to hear those cases because they said, look, you already litigated it. It's already been resolved in state court. If you think they got it wrong, go appeal that decision. Don't come to us. So it's a more difficult process to take a violation on a judgment and move it to federal court. It's not impossible, but it's a more difficult process. But if they got a judgment and now post-judgment collections, they're doing things that are illegal. So again, threatening you after a judgment, things that they can't do. Sometimes we'll have clients who had a judgment against them and then the debt collector will say, well, we're going to bring you back to court and sue you again. It's like, well, you can't sue me again. You already sued me. So that's a lie. Or they're adding on fees that they're not entitled to. Those are good cases that we'll file on their behalf. But if the case is, I don't think I should have had a judgment, or I don't think I owed the money, those are things that you're going to have to bring back to the state court.
What if they didn't get served? Like, you know, I mean, some people just genuinely don't get served for these.
100%.
Yeah.
If it's a one-off where, you know, they served you at the wrong address, you weren't served, again, you're going to, first step is you're going to have to go back to state court. You're going to have to hire a local attorney or do it on your own and get the judgment removed. And when you weren't served, that's not a difficult process. Then we can go to federal court. Mm-hmm. But as long as the judgment's out there, most federal courts don't want to hear it. They're like, get rid of the judgment and then come to us.
What type of an attorney would you need to help you with removing a judgment?
You just need like a general practitioner, someone local in your area. that knows the court system well.
My last question is, you know, now that the judgment thing came up, was the Dunning letters. Mm-hmm. So these letters are the initial letter that the collection agencies are supposed to send out to let you, the consumer, know that that they're going to, you know, be on your credit report, right? And that you know, they've taken this debt and they're trying to collect for it, right? I think.
So, yeah, well, so a Dunning letter is the initial letter, and their responsibilities are to tell you how you can dispute a debt, so, or how you're supposed to dispute a debt. Mm-hmm. And a Dunning letter is triggered after the first communication. So what the law says is within 5 days of the initial communication, a debt collector has to tell you of your rights to dispute a debt. Some debt collectors will skip this step and just put it on your credit report. And the reason being is because courts have held that a reporting doesn't trigger that initial communication requirement. So you may see ERC, for example, pop up in your credit report and you're like, hey, I never got a letter. Legally, they're allowed to do this. However, if you now dispute the debt or contact ERC and say, look, I saw you on my credit report, what's going on here, or anything, any communication you have with ERC, now you on your own triggered that right. So if they don't send you a letter within 5 days of that communication, now they violated the law.
Okay, so just to clarify, because I just had someone call me and say, Jefferson Capital is on their report. They never got a Dunning letter, right? Mm-hmm. Them telling me that I could write them a letter to verify and validate the debt, and they have 5 days to contact.
You could write them a letter and say anything, or you could call them. It doesn't have to be necessarily a dispute, but any communication you have with them, now within 5 days, they have to send you what that Dunning letter is. They have to notify you of your rights.
Okay, well, that's a good one then, because actually they called her on the phone also.
Okay.
So from that phone call, they have 5 days to send her a Dunning letter, right?
That's right. Exactly right.
Okay. And if she doesn't receive it, what am I supposed to do? Call you?
That's right. You can call me.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Awesome.
One last question that just came up. You were talking about interest accruing, right? So there's a company that has told one of our customers interest is accruing. It's constant. Mm-hmm. Now, at what point, like, this is a debt collector, who gets to decide when that interest accrues? Is it the original?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Okay, so first off, you want to look at the original contract. Does the original contract say that they can charge interest? And if it does, or this is where it's difficult because you're in California. In California, the actual state law says that everyone can charge interest on these debts. They don't need it in the contract. But your question is, who decides? It has to be the current creditor or the original creditor. So we have cases where, let's just say Verizon has a debt. They're accruing interest and they're legally allowed to, either because it's in the contract or they're in a state like California. If they decide to charge off the debt and say, we're no longer charging interest, we're done. They then sell it or hire a third party, and that third party decides on their own to put back the interest that Verizon waived. That, I would think, is a violation. We would sue on their case like that.
Mm, okay. That's awesome.
Wow. Great. Any last words, Ari?
I appreciate the time. I had a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on. I hope you'll have me on again. No, just debt collectors assume that consumers don't know their rights. So it's very important to get this information out, because in reality, most consumers don't know their rights. Most consumers I talk to are either shocked or don't believe me when I tell them their rights to fight back. So information is power. Go out, learn as much as you can, and use that power to fight back if you're having debt collectors violating your rights.
Yes. Yeah, you know,
it's funny. What I always tell people is, with collections, they have to do one or two things. They ignore it or they pay it. And they shouldn't do either one until, you know, You don't want to ignore the call because it could be a violation. You don't want to pay. You want to make sure you pay. And then, of course, verifying and validating that could get you paid, you know. So, yeah, that's awesome.
That's right. That's right.
Well, thank you so much for always, you know, being there for our customers. We really do appreciate that and your time today. Hope you have a great weekend. Yeah, we'll definitely have you on for some very specific reasons. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Have a good weekend, girls. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Credit Alchemy. Check us out next week and every Friday. Talk to you soon.